friends. Sam Rogowski here on the Sam Nation Radio Network. And let's get right to it. Yes, I'm going to unpackage what's happening here with the midterms. I sense a degree of panic out there. I met with a friend for lunch this week, and I would describe him as a young, diehard Trumpist. And I don't want to exactly name and shame him. He's a guy who absolutely 100% wants to see things go well in the midterms and fears that they won't. And I suspect many of you are feeling much of the same thing. So his theory, he says, Sam, I know you know a lot about this, but I really think the Democrats are going to win. I think there's going to be an impeachment just like there was in the Clinton years where Trump will get impeached in the House. And then he will be, of course, exonerated in the Senate and will go on to win re-election, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I still fundamentally disagree, and I have reasons, and there are indicators out there for why I think that this is not true and why I think that you, my friends, ought not to panic, at least not just yet. It's not the data. The data, by the way, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute, but the data is on our side, right? We have the indicators, the observations based on polling, which districts lean Democratic, which lean Republican, et cetera, et cetera. All those numbers favor Republicans, favor the GOP keeping the House. But the bigger issue here, the thing that you've got to know, is that it's about the ideas and it's about the branding that these two parties have. Now, admittedly, right now, the Republicans do not have the best branding, because they are sort of a petite obstructor to the great Donald Trump, right? So they're this kind of lukewarm, don't really like Trump. There's a lot of never Trumpers in Congress. People who themselves see their role as being that of a gatekeeper, of adult supervision, and that in turn risks alienating Trump voters who they desperately need in order to get reelected. In some of these tough districts, you have disenfranchised Democrats who in 2016 voted for Trump. And I've said it again and again and again that you've got to get, Trump supporters to get out and vote for mediocre GOP standard fare, blah, 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 vanilla candidates. And these voters are not excited about political milquetoast. They do not want more of the same. They don't want cold porridge. To these voters, Trump is a spicy enchilada. Not day old cereal. But these candidates out there, I got to tell you, there are a number of races where the Republican candidates are just blah. And that's the problem that the Republican Party has. They've got blah candidates. But on the other side, the Democrats, well, they have arguably some very exciting candidates. The problem is the only person that it's tingling the toes of are a bunch of junior Leninists. And this is not who we are as a country. We're not a socialist republic. We aren't Sweden. We are not fill in the blank. We're not Great Britain. This brand, this democratic socialism, you've heard this term. You've heard it bandied about. And these, by the way, these democratic congresspersons or aspiring congresspersons out there are throwing this term out as if it were, candy. It's, I'm a democratic socialist, democratic socialist. I'll give you some concrete examples here. And I think the only person that is titillating is that guy who's living at home with his parents, who's being threatened with eviction by his own mom, 36 years old, hasn't showered in a week, doesn't have a job, likes to play video games. And that's, I mean, that I get it. Socialism is very attractive to somebody who is failing to launch. But for the rest of us, even for a lot of millennials that I know, the idea, the concept that the state, that government take a more assertive, aggressive, and powerful role in their lives is just a non-starter. I don't care how you repackage it. People understand fundamentally that this is not a good thing. And the Democratic Party right now is branding itself far more left than they ever have, than they have certainly in my life. And I remember this well, a little bit of history. You remember Clinton, who was, I mean, bar none, whatever you want to say about Clinton, a very tactful, skilled politician. And when he was elected in 92, he, in his first half term, tacked left. And he tacked left because Hillary was wearing the pants in that in the White House at the time and appointed herself to a variety of positions. And one of them was a commission on overhaul of the healthcare system. And she wanted to get out there front and center and what? Bring about healthcare for all, single payer system, nationalized healthcare, a la Canada, a la Great Britain, etc. And it crashed and burned. You remember this. And behind the scenes, you had Clinton and his strategists, you know, Carville, probably Morris, too. Stephanopoulos, all these people. And mind you, right, Carville's a leftist. But he goes, we're going to lose because they got their A-money monies handed to them in the primaries. Because the American public went out to vote as a protest to that crazy leftism. They liked other stuff that Clinton was doing. Clinton wasn't unpopular. His numbers were high. The protest wasn't, it was not against Clinton. It was against the policies. Leftist socialist nonsense doesn't sell. And yet, over and over again in these primary contests, and you saw it with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in New York, unseating a 6, 7, or 8 term congressman. And now being a virtual shoo-in as a candidate, I love it every time Ocasio-Cortez goes out there on the cable news shows and does a talk about. Remember, those are votes one by one going to the Republicans in the midterm. She is terrible. But the Democrats right now have a funding problem. See, this is where they're screwed. They are fundraising off their base. Using the rhetoric of Ocasio-Cortez, which is on one hand killing them, absolutely destroying them with the with the American public, normal people. We'll call those November voters, right? November voters, they're getting turned off, but they're fundraising up a blue streak off this advertising and off this crazy rhetoric. Things like abolishing ICE. And single payer health care is back and not, by the way, not Obamacare. We're talking about health care where it's free health care, where the state pays it, where the state hires doctors. Doctors are no longer private employees and the government is solely responsible for your health. And I'll tell you what, we all Americans, okay, we've all been at the DMV. And if this is it, all the Republicans have to do in November. Well, October, start running ads of people standing in the DMV in their respective states and saying, this is going to be your health care if the party of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez comes to power. This is what your life is going to be like. The other awkward thing about running against Trump, because that's, of course, a big aspect of this. You know, we're the party of resistance. We're the checks and balance, right? We're going to run against Trump. Well, for one, do you see his approval rating today of 50%? I mean, Trump, think about this. Think about all the bad news that Trump got, the Manafort trial. Literally, his campaign manager's on trial right now. Trump is waging war against everyone from Jim Acosta on down. I mean, and he's still at 50%. This guy's made of Teflon. If I were a Democratic Party strategist right now, I'd start, you know, slitting down and not across. I mean, it's bad. And yet, I'm blown away when I turn on cable news and I see, you know, very respected, erudite figures such as Larry Sabato talking about how it's this whole thing. Oh, the Democrats are favored, blah, 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 blah. And all we, you and I, have to do is rewind the tape back to October of 2016. And it was these same people with their same lame predictions that turned out to be totally wrong. And they were wrong, by the way, because they're letting their own bias into the equation. Now, I don't trust polling, I don't know any of that. But when you look at the congressional map, I promised you I was going to talk about the data, because the data backs this up. You're going to be at the, you know, water cooler on Monday, and people are going to say, oh, yeah, well, Mitch Trump is going to be a blue wave. And you're going to say, oh, well, okay. One, the Democrats have turned, you know, to Karl Marx as their leader, you know, because he's more alive right now than Nancy Pelosi. And two, here's some math. In the congressional races, right, there's the ones that lean Democratic, the ones that lean Republican, and the toss-ups. Republicans have 201, Democrats 199, and those are both likely and leaning on both sides. So it's about even. You see, this is where you can get tempted to go, all right, it could go either way, because the 35 toss-ups could make all the difference. But I got to say, when I look at these districts, when I look at these toss-up districts, do you know that two of those districts right now are Democrat and 31 of those are Republican? I mean, you've got to have, you really have to have districts churn. I mean, the Democrats would have to pick up longtime Republican districts. Now, is it possible? Sure it is. But I like going into the microcosm of this. One race in particular in Utah that I've been following closely for personal reasons, there's a very popular mayor of Salt Lake County who is running against Mia Love. You know her, of course, she's black, very well-spoken Republican candidate, congresswoman, excuse me, who's, I think, now running for her second or third term. She's got a big brand name recognition nationally and very much so locally in her district. Now, she's running against a guy, Ben McAdams. Fair disclosure here, my brother-in-law, very good guy. Honestly, if we could get a Democrat like that in California, you know, things might actually work. But my point is, he's still trailing. This is a guy who's popular. This is a guy who has a proven track record as mayor of Salt Lake County, but he's still trailing in that race. And all the antipathy that is or has been built up against Trump and Trumpism and making America great again and ICE and all these hot button issues that the Democrats have made such a big stink about. Actually, when you break it down into the microcosm, into the specific race, because at the end of the day, it comes down to that each of these districts, what's going on in that town, in that series of towns, in that county, whatever geographic area it is. And those people are looking at the two candidates. And one candidate, he's not necessarily, or she in this case, Mia Love, is not necessarily a vote for Trump, but she's a vote for, you know, Paul Ryan, who's milquetoast. But voting for this Ben guy, who's a great guy, a great candidate, that potentially is a vote for Nancy Pelosi. And worse yet, we all know Nancy, many strokes Pelosi's on her way out, but worse yet, who's coming up behind her? Well, hell's bells if it's Ocasio-Cortez and her troop of Democrat socialists. That's not going to sell in Utah. I don't care how much they don't like Trump. Do you see what I'm getting at here? So it's not in the bag. Yes, it's a toss-up, but it's not in the bag, because when you start to look at all these individual districts, it's not like these toss-ups are, you know, 50-50, 40-60. You know, some would have to turn Democrat, some would have to turn Republican. These are districts that could that are traditionally Republican and have been so for years. And now you're still dealing with that factor, too. Remember this. Those Trump voters, it's an unknown. It's an X factor, because those are the people that many times in the past voted for Democrats, especially in states like Indiana, Ohio, Wisconsin, Michigan, so forth and so on. So just be still, my friends. Be still. And remember, the Democrats, you know, bringing all these goofballs and electing all these absolute idiots in their primaries, you know, was it Shakespeare that said, hoist by your own retard? Sam Rogowski, back right after this.
In this present crisis, government is the solution to our problem. Government is the problem. And Sam Nation is the solution. Of course, you need jelly beans for that.
Yes, I know that last segment probably rained on your dreams if you are an anti-Trump, life-hating Democrat. Sorry, the blue wave is not coming. And by the way, if it is in the midterms and if it does put more Democrats in Congress, even if it puts enough Democrats in Congress to take control of the House, I don't think it's happening in the Senate. The way the numbers shake out there, I think the Republicans stand to pick up a couple seats. And there, by the way, the Senate, the big thing that you have to know about the Senate is Brett Kavanaugh. Do you remember who Brett Kavanaugh is? No, he's not a senator. He is the latest, the most recent nominee for the Supreme Court that Trump put forward. And his confirmation is pending. His hearing is pending now before the Senate. And do you know the latest what's been going on? Well, the Democrats are requesting a large volume of documents. They want to go back to stuff that Kavanaugh did when he was a staff attorney in the Bush White House. And back in the early 2000s. And one thing Kavanaugh has a bit of a problem for him is that he's a thorough guy. He's one of these terrific legal minds, and he's a terrific writer. And so he wrote a lot, and the Democrats want to go through all of it. Now, let me ask you why. Why are they going through all of it? And most importantly, why is this relevant to the Senate races that are happening in November? So it's related, right? They want to go through all that to stall. It's a stalling tactic. Rand Paul this week said he's voting for Kavanaugh. So the Republicans already have the votes. It's a done deal. I don't want to let anybody down here and jump the shark, but that Kavanaugh's in. He will be nominated to the Supreme Court. Now, I keep hearing this nonsense on the news about how the Democrats are stalling because they hope to win the Senate and have enough votes to block him. So they're stalling to block Kavanaugh from getting nominated. They're blocking him past November, requesting documents and postponing the hearings. But that's not what it is. The Democrats know they can't stop him, but they're fundraising, right? They're every single mailer, every email, every ad. It's stop Kavanaugh. Kavanaugh's going to take away Roe v. Wade. Women will not be able to do anything with their bodies. Don't worry, though. We're going to bring socialized medicine, and then, you know, no one will have a say. At least it won't just target women, I guess, right? But you see, they're fundraising off of it. They need to milk this golden goose. I'm mixing metaphors there, but they need to take advantage of this as long as possible. The other part of it is they've got a number of vulnerable Democrats longtime Democratic senators that are in red states. So blue senators in red states, in states that voted for Trump big time. You think it's going to go over well with the Trump voters in those states if their their senator votes against Kavanaugh, Trump's pick? You know, even Republicans who don't like Trump love Kavanaugh. It's the best issue Trump has. It galvanizes the entire right wing and center of the country. So the Democrats are taking the single most unifying issue Trump has to play with and are picking a fight over it. And they're picking a fight over it because they're fundraising off of it. But they also want to stall past the election. So they're vulnerable Democrats in these key states, like Joe Manchin, right? They want to make sure that those guys don't have to go on record as voting against or for him. And it's a lose-lose. This couldn't be any better. It's a lose-lose for the Democrats either way. So, if a guy like Manchin votes yes on Kavanaugh, he saves his own hide, right? It's the right thing to do, first of all. There's no reason to vote against him. He's qualified to be a Supreme Court judge or justice. But what's the other part of it? Right now, he saves his hide politically for himself. But how demoralizing is that? How demoralizing if you are a California Democrat, a millennial, a Democratic socialist, and you have literally been curled up in the fetal position thinking that Kavanaugh is going to end Roe v. Wade and God knows what else. Turn your public school into a parochial institution. Right. If that's what you're thinking and your Democratic Party can't stop it. And Chuck Schumer can't stop it. And all these guys can't do anything about it. Man, you go into that election, you're a little deflated. Maybe you just stay home and smoke pot. Right? See, everyone that is writing the Republican Party obituary, cut it out. Cut it out. Look at the Democrats. My God, it's really a tale of who is worse. It's not they're not nobody's playing a game here, but there's a lot. They're all fighting for who's on, DNF. Don't go anywhere. Quick break. I'll talk about Paul Manafort. Interesting developments. Birds of a feather, if you will, in his trial. Back after this.
I was listening the other day to a friend of mine. His name is Sam Majowski. You'll find him very interesting. He's very stylish. He's always wearing his suit. And if you want to hear someone's opinion that absolutely is correct, you listen to Sam. Anyone else is a waste of time.
Sam Rajofsky, Sam Nation, rarely wrong, always right, here on the Sam Nation Radio Network. As you know, the trial of Paul Manafort began this week in a courtroom near Washington, D.C. Now, the reason the trial is going on there has nothing to do with Trump, has nothing to do with the White House. Manafort is being tried there because he lives there. His apartment is somewhere, I don't know, four blocks away from the courthouse. So that is the appropriate district in which the charges originally were filed and where the trial is to be held. Now, the judge, a guy's name is Elliot, and the judge is he's kind of a tough guy. He's known for regularly cutting off lawyers, interjecting commentary, slapping down, lawyers that maybe get a little too wordy. We lawyers do this from time to time. We love the sound of our own voice, which, of course, is why, they should get radio shows and, keep it brief in court. So this judge. One of the things that he is doing is he's been, I think, fairly aggressive on cutting down the prosecution and talk about all of the luxury goods and luxury lifestyle in Manafort's life. Now, there's something in federal law, in federal court, there's this rule is the same in state and federal court, but it has to do with restricting evidence that is more prejudicial than helpful. The question here is, Manafort's not being tried for collusion. He's not being tried for anything related to Trump. It has to do with not paying taxes, hiding income that he was getting from the Ukraine years and years ago. I think he ended the deal with the Ukraine sometime in 2014 or 2015. So this was a while ago, certainly before Trump ran for president. So anyway, Manafort's on trial, says he, you know, didn't pay millions and millions of taxes. And one of the things that they're bringing in are pictures. And honestly, I'll tell you, this is so funny. They're bringing in pictures of stuff that they found that the U.S. Marshals, the FBI, whoever it was that stormed the apartment in that no-knock raid that they did on him, maybe now, what is it, 8 months ago, whatever it was. Things like his tailored suits, but also some jackets. And there is one that is being talked about, two actually, that are being talked about very heavily in the news. One of them is a python jacket made out of snakes. Now, I have my daughter, Vera, here in the studio. She's sitting next to producer Robbie. What do you think, Vera, what do you think about a jacket made out of snakes? No? Ew? Ew. From the mouth of babes. Ew. What about one made out of ostrich? Would it matter if the feathers were still attached? What if it still had the feathers on it? Would that be cool? Oh, if you were allergic to feathers? Well, anyway, he's got these bird jackets and the python snake jackets, and they cost a fortune, right? They're $15,000, $14,000, whatever they are. I don't know why the judge is letting this in. This really infuriates me. The question is, did you commit fraud? And you can prove that by showing that you brought in X dollars of income and paid Y dollars of taxes when you should have paid Z value in taxes. It's the elements that need to be. You don't have to prove that you spent the money. You don't have to prove that you bought really gaudy, ugly jackets that even my 7-year-old thinks sound goofy. That none of that is relevant. So the exclusionary rule for irrelevant evidence, I think, should have barred all of this. And what really bothers me about this is how, remember Dennis Kozlovsky, who was the Tyco CEO, and the allegations there were that he basically pilfered the company, a company that he grew from almost virtually a mom and pop operation to a multi-billion dollar enterprise that it remains today. His trial in New York City, all that trial consisted of was showing his lavish lifestyle. And you've got 12, you know, potatoes on the jury, freaking welfare recipients, teachers, whatnot. Sorry if you're a teacher and I compared you to a welfare recipient, but you get my point. Blue collar people sitting there. Yeah, yeah. What a horrible guy. What a rich, filthy, rich guy. Yeah. Put him to jail. And the guy's still sitting in jail. And when you look actually at his conviction and see what he was convicted of, I don't even know if they necessarily met their case. So Manafort, what matters here is, did he cheat on his taxes? But how he spent that money, that is a tactic the prosecution is using just to get the jury mad at the defendant. And that's nonsense. I hate when this is used. It's class baiting, envy baiting. It is a typical Democratic Party behavior. Yuck. So the judge, for all of his bravado and tough talk, he needs to ramp it up. This is unacceptable. Sam Rogowski, back right after this.
You're looking for a show that doesn't sugarcoat the truth. Sam Nation will accommodate you.
Burjovsky, Sam Nation. Okay. Ocasio-Cortez is not the only Democratic socialist out there who is on the ballot come November. There will be at least one other one potentially if she wins the primary next week. And her name is Sarah Smith. This is in a congressional district in Washington state. I would think, given the makeup of the district, as I'm looking at it here, this gal has a chance. I've not seen any polling. And I personally, right, not an insane person, I'm loving these races that are going to these nut jobs. So I'm hoping that she wins. We wish her best here at Sam Nation. Great exchange with Bill Hemmer on Wednesday on Fox News. And here is Sarah Smith talking about health care. Hemmer, you can see, he's almost wanting to laugh as he's talking to her. Listen to their exchange.
Free health care and free college and open borders. How much does that cost?
Open border. So right now, people talk a lot about cost when it comes to these kinds of things, Bill. So they talk a lot about cost for a single-payer health care system. The system we have now costs taxpayers $47
trillion. $47 trillion.
And a single-payer system? Yeah. And a single-payer system would wind up changing that cost. It would reduce that cost to $33 trillion.
So you're
that's
actually,
a figure that's widely quoted.
Yeah, you're saving us money then, is that right?
Single-payer systems save money.
But who's paying the 30? Okay, I'm assuming, let's just assume her numbers are right. This is all made up. By the way, you get a Democrat talking about math, talking about budgeting. I mean, this is like when I talk about football. Okay, it's a non-starter. But let's just assume her numbers are right. This is like somebody arguing with you that a Mercedes is going to cost you $55,000. And a Honda is going to cost you $35,000 for, you know, similarly sized models. Well, first of all, if you've got the government plan, how are they going to save all this money, right? They're going to provide more health care for less money. Where is that going to come from? And by the way, every time a liberal talks to you about a great new program, how it's going to save money, does that ever happen? Ever in the history of liberal insanity? No, it doesn't. We're Californians, right? What was that bullet train going to cost? And what has it cost? Every projection that a Democrat makes about some social benefit is always, always, always understated. But there's another cost, and it's a quality cost. And the idea, right, that if, I don't know, an insurer like Blue Cross has a certain amount of inefficiency in it, that dollars spent to Blue Cross go, some percentage, some significant percentage, don't end up going to your healthcare, but end up going to the operation of Blue Cross, Blue Shield, right? And that's a bad thing. The idea is that these people have is that the state is going to come in and be more efficient in their management of healthcare than a private insurance company. Are you insane? Obviously, this is what drug use does. Vera's still here. Vera, don't do drugs, okay? Otherwise, you're going to think like these people, right? Yeah, okay. You're nodding your head. My daughter is in the studio in case you missed it. All right. This is absolutely insane. All right, so, and she continues. Now, the role of government, continuing with Bill Hemmer, here, Hemmer asks her, so what do you think of this? And this is a great answer from the Ms. Smith, Washington congressional candidate for the Democratic Party.
Why do you believe that the government can do a better job of taking care of people than people can actually do on their own?
Because that's the point of government. It's to empower people to be able to self-determine. The point of government is to be able to make sure that people can choose their own fate and choose their own future without having to worry if they can go to the doctor. It's about the government stepping in to care for the most basic needs of people.
I don't know anybody in the VA who wouldn't prefer to just go to their own doctor if they could, okay? I don't know anybody. Producer Robbie's a veteran. Am I talking out of my A-Money money here? No. Okay. The role of the government, lady, okay, is for the government to get out of my way, your way, all of our ways, and just be over there in the corner, maintain some roads, keep us safe, okay, and take as little of our tax money as possible. I wonder how many people come November are going to be voting under the influence. It's drugs. There's no other explanation for it. All right, Sam Rogowski, back right after this.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, here's Johnny.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, on the show tonight is Sam Rogowski. Now, what Sam is the leading word in correct thinking, as opposed to Ed, which is drunk thinking. And that's usually where the left ends up, on the wrong side of right.
Okay, so excited about this. So, this democratic socialist label is one that they're actually embracing, right? I know I use some hyperbole here from time to time. For entertainment purposes. And this is a liberty I take as your host as we take you through 2 hours of radio hot sniggity goodness. Now, but you've got to understand something. This label, this democratic socialism deal, is one that these millennial Democrats and their, you know, and their older cohorts are embracing and are branding themselves with. There is a great piece in Vox, which is an online publication you may be familiar with, and there's a gal by the name of Megan Day. She spells it Megan, if that helps you understand how it's spelled. And she apparently is a writer for a magazine called Jacobin, and she's a left-winger, right? Heavy left. Hard left. And the article starts with basically, people are calling it democratic socialism. People on the right are freaking out. People in the Democratic, some people are saying, oh, I don't know if that's really the label, blah, 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 blah. And then she says, she writes this, quote, I'm a staff writer at the socialist magazine Jacobin and a member of DSA. By the way, DSA, what is that? The Democratic Socialists of America? And here's the truth. This is her direct quote right from this piece in Vox. In the long run, democratic socialists want to end capitalism. And we want to do that by pursuing a reform agenda today in an effort to revive a politics focused on class hierarchy and inequality in the United States. The eventual goal, and it's a continuation of the quote, right? The eventual goal is to transform the world to promote everyone's needs rather than to produce massive profits for a small handful of citizens. There is a donkey shortage in Venezuela, a country that needs donkeys because as the top oil producer in the world, they can't produce oil because they've confiscated all the means of production and turned it over to, quote unquote, the people. So, right, they're sitting on oil. They can't put gas in their own cars, let alone export it. They're out of money and they're running out of donkeys because there isn't enough food and people are killing donkeys so they don't starve. And these morons, these idiots, these mushheads, these products of the, like, I mean, I know I went to public school, even was in Irvine, but still, you know, my teachers were all burnt out hippies for the most part. And what did they teach? They thought that this stuff was a great idea. They were more, you know, secretly back then, early 80s, they were kind of on the side of the Soviet Union, wink, wink, you know, we're pushing for the underdog here. I go to UCI, and there was not even a wink, wink. Good morning, class. Let me teach you about communism. It's a great idea. America is evil. in a generation or two of our brightest youths went through these schools, went through this security blanket, right? This idea of public education for all, education is free, blah, 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 right? It all got paid for, student loans, bankrupted our country. And what did they get out of it? This insanity. And I'm speaking to you, right, as the son of refugees from this type of insanity. My parents fled a system that embraced everything that this woman is writing about. It ought to terrify you. And what the critical takeaway here is that there is a stated intent, a stated purpose, that the beginnings is just a little bit of activism, a little bit of rhetoric, but they really are as extreme as the title socialist implies, all right? So don't let them fool you. They're talking about it. They're putting a pen on paper. All right, I'll get into the press. Trump v. the press when we come back. Interesting developments, in case you missed it, and my thoughts on that. Yeah, we'll have to rewind a little bit. We'll have to go back to maybe 2015 because, yeah, rarely wrong. But I was wrong about something, and I'll talk about that when we come back. Don't go anywhere. Sam Rogowski, Sam Nation, on the Sam Nation Radio Network.
We shall fight on the airwaves. We shall fight on Twitter and Facebook. We shall broadcast our program, whatever the cost may be. And if Sam Nation lasts for 1,000 years, men will say this was their finest hour.
Giddy up! Here we go. I'm not talking to one of those meat donkeys in Venezuela, but rather to myself, getting the energy going here for our second hour of Sam Nation here on the Sam Nation Radio Network. Happy Friday. I'll tell you, this fight between Trump and the media goes back to the very beginnings of his campaign. And one of the things I remember saying at the time when my first gut visceral reaction to this that I shared with you was that this is a fight you just can't win. You have the press are an institution. I said that correctly. I mean the press corps and all its members. And the mainstream media, I understand. You have Fox News and the like, but you've got every major newspaper in the country, a majority of what is online that has name brand recognition, right? All of it can really, truly shape public opinion in a powerful way. And I said, this is just, you pick a fight with the press and you're going to end up getting screwed because not necessarily all because the press is so powerful, but also because what? The press can win simply by drawing you into a fight that diminishes you. Now, I'll say this today as a correction of what I said back in whatever it was, 2015. I'm going to tell you that no one in the history of media in this country has waged a more successful battle with the media than Donald Trump. And I'll say, I know, look, this whole thing with Acosta this week. Well, Acosta goes to the Trump rally. Okay, this is just a bit of background. Jim Acosta, who is the CNN White House correspondent, the face of Trump hate on CNN. He goes to a Trump rally, and Trump's up there, you know, doing his standard spiel about how the media is the fake news, media is enemy of the people, and the crowd's eating it up, right? These are Trumpists who, when they do turn into CNN, get hear nothing but a network calling them stupid, ignorant, racist, and so forth and so on. So they have... These are not people who are mindlessly being driven to a conclusion simply because of their God worship of Donald Trump. These are people whose own relationship is fractured with various media outlets because when they do turn in, hear nothing but bad news, not about just the president, but about themselves. Make sense? Okay. So Acosta basically, there's a great clip that sums up Acosta's view on what it was like to be at the Trump rally. I love this. Play the tape.
Honestly, it felt like we weren't in America anymore. I don't know how to put it any more plainly than that. Americans should not be treating their fellow Americans in this way. He is whipping these crowds up into a frenzy to the point where they really want to come after us. When you refer to the members of the press as the enemy of the people, you're essentially putting targets on our backs.
Mm-hmm. Cry me a river, Jimmy. Let me ask you something. Do you have a sticker? Do you have a Trump sticker? Would you put a Trump sticker on your car? I am a provocateur. I have been producer Robbie. He's nodding his head. But Vera, do I like to tease? Vera's here in the studio. Do I like to tease at home? Yes. Okay. Do you know what the word provocateur means? Somebody who likes to provoke. Do I like to provoke? Yeah. See, there you go. I am not putting a Trump sticker on my car. And the reason for it is I have nice cars that I like. And I would like to return to them and not have them be destroyed. I was just talking about this with a friend of mine who is... I used to wear my Trump hat from time to time. I wouldn't do that now either. And why is that? The reason is routinely and regularly on the mainstream media, on the news, you have Trump supporters be called racists, Nazis, bigots, horrible things that, of course, you and I are not. But who is that whipping into a frenzy? The nutters out there, right? These drugged up leftists who now no longer want to have civil discourse, who no longer want to have a discussion, but think of themselves in some, I don't know, incredible terms as you and I, as Trump supporters, not being worthy of even having a discussion with, and that we are literally enemies of the state, of what it is, in their view, what it is to be American. Now, how does this all tie into Trump and Trump winning or losing a war with the media? It is better when a fight that you're having with someone, I'm putting myself here in Trump's shoes, he's having a fight with the media, right? The media is saying unkind things about him, okay? The media is reporting, some of it's true and most of it isn't, but it's bad press. Trump does not like bad press. So he's gone to war with the media. Now, the best way to win a war with an enemy you're fighting is to let other people fight the war for you. And even better than that, the best possible outcome or development is when your opponent begins to disassemble, right? Begins to self-destruct because you have gotten him so wound up and cray-cray, as the young people say these days. Trump has made the media, listen, trust me on this, the media is going cray-cray. I tune in CNN and we play clips like this all the time. I mean, here's a compilation, right, of a series of people from Andrea Mitchell to Chuck Todd, Sunny Hostin on The View. Here's just a little potpourri of media madness. They are so offended that Trump is attacking them, but listen to how hysterical they're being.
He has very deliberately set up the press as the enemy of the people, and it's not benign. I mean, this is something that we first heard from Joseph Stalin.
This president has started this war against the media because he doesn't like that the truth is being reported. These are the acts, in my opinion, of a dictator. Dictators attack the press routinely.
He has successfully brainwashed his voters. And as we saw last night, they will scream and curse and threaten any reporters who challenge the president.
It's like James Jones and they drank the Kool-Aid, and I'm afraid that he could incite them to violence. A lot of them are on the edge anyway.
This kind of unfocused, visceral anger, it can lead to this.
That noise right there is Chuck Todd playing a clip, a video clip of the Charlottesville car attack. Very graphic clip. See, it's you know where you begin to get people to disassemble is when their self-importance, self-involvement becomes blinding. Look, if you're the media, how do you take down the president? You take down the president if you don't like him, right? If you think that he's a bad guy and he's out there and he's worthy of being exposed for the fraud that he is, right? Following this train of thought, you do it by being even keel. You do it by avoiding ad hominem personal attacks. You don't get offended about it. You don't make it about you. You have to be invisible. You're just a conveyor of facts, of reporting. You're an unbiased party to the action. You're not even a party to the action. But what we have here right now is Trump has managed to wind all these people up. He's like little mice, little wind-up mice. And he's just winding them up. And then Acosta goes running around. Now he actually said he was so sick to his stomach in a White House briefing with Sarah Huckabee Sanders, that he had to leave the room. Now, fact of the matter is, he actually left the room in a huff. And what preceded it is what preceded him leaving the room is actually really a great summation of where we are right now as a country. This is Sarah Huckabee Sanders literally talking down to Jimmy Acosta and saying, look, this isn't about what Trump is saying. It's on you. Listen to this.
Repeatedly, the media resorts to personal attacks without any content other than to incite anger. The media has attacked me personally on a number of occasions, including your own network, said I should be harassed as a life sentence, that I should be choked. When I was hosted by the Correspondents Association, of which almost all of you are members of, you brought a comedian up to attack my appearance and call me a traitor to my own gender. In fact, as far as I know, I'm the first press secretary in the history of the United States that's required Secret Service protection. The media continues to ratchet up the verbal assault against the president and everyone in this administration. And certainly we have a role to play, but the media has a role to play for the discourse in this country as well.
When Trump retires, leaves the presidency after a second term, and we all have an opportunity to take a little bit of a breather, Jim Acosta, CNN, MSNBC, Andrea Mitchell, F. Chuck Todd, all these dummies, history is not going to be kind to them. Sarah Huckabee Sanders is not the first press secretary in the history of this country to take a defensive position protecting her boss. To basically make a... I mean, and this... And she's right. She's right. Now, Trump has baited the media into going so low they could walk under a pregnant rattlesnake. That's where they are. He has dragged the media into the gutter and exposed them for the absolute, you know, well, not just the losers. They're vainglorious in their own over-exaggerated feelings of self-worth and self-importance. And the comedy of it all is that as CNN's ratings continue to tank, these people are, in reality, less and less relevant. But they continue to think of themselves as if this were, you know, the Walter Cronkite era. ABC, NBC, CBS, and nothing else. Well, I'm sorry, Chuck Todd, Andrea Mitchell. That ship has sailed. It's gone, never to return. And that is in part due to the fact that you abused your power. The era of Watergate, where every journalism student dreams of being the next Bob Woodward, who has a book coming out about Trump, and I expect it will be maybe slightly more accurate than, oh my gosh, who was the other guy who wrote the book? No. Who was the gadfly, the New York writer who wrote the tell-all book about Trump? Yeah, Fire and the Fury, yes. It'll be maybe a little touch more accurate. These people are all looking at Trump through their field of vision, through their view of the world. But they're in an echo chamber. These journalism students all go, they all want to be the next Woodward, the next Bernstein, take down a president. But they don't have they lack the moral authority. And they lack the moral authority because they let themselves get baited by Trump. I'm being extra generous to the media here. Trump exposed them for the weak, silly, inconsequential people that they are. They took the low road and continue to take the low road on a daily basis. And Sanders basically says, yeah, you had a comedian come to your dinner, call me fat, horrible things, traitor to my gender. You got people on your network threatening to choke me, kill me, et cetera, and you tolerate it. And you come in here and lecture me and lecture the president about civility to the press? Who are you? And Acosta's answer to this is telling. He walks out of the room. This reminds me, and I love my friend Matt, you know, I mentioned the story, how we were all out to a nice evening and drinks with his crazy left-wing sister, and she can't debate me. She doesn't want to debate anybody, but I'm not worthy of debate. And it ends with her throwing a punch. It didn't hurt. That's not the point. The point is nobody wants to have a conversation anymore. I'll debate the issues. I'll talk to you about it. But trust me, the bellwether is here. If you put on a Hillary shirt, or you put on a socialism shirt, or you put on a Che Guevara shirt, and then walk, you know, anywhere basically in California, and compare that with what you get when you put on a Trump hat, there's no comparison. And the media is to blame for that. It's not Trump. It's the media. And it's going to hurt them. Look, Trump's ratings, 50%. So it's working. Sam Murjovsky, back right after this.
In this present crisis, government is the solution to our problem. Government is the problem. And Sam Nation is the solution. Of course, you need jelly beans for that.
Sam Murjovsky, Sam Nation. Okay, we have a special guest, a VIP, two VIPs in the studio, as a matter of fact. And right here, sitting on my lap, is none other than my Vera. And Vera, you want to say hi?
Hi.
All right. What do you think of the studio?
I like it.
You've wanted to come for a while, right?
Uh huh.
So now that you're here, what do you think?
Cool.
Yeah. All right. So now, Vera, I'm going to ask you. Have you been following the show? Have you been listening?
Yeah.
What's been your favorite part so far? This is radio. We got to actually say something.
I do not know. Yeah, probably, actually.
Well, you got to say it.
playing the clips.
Yeah. Did producer Robbie let you push some buttons?
Yes.
Awesome. Now, hey, so you know what I actually would want to know? I want to know if, so you go to, you're in elementary school, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And you just finished the first grade and you're heading into second grade.
Yeah.
Right. Now, in the first grade, when I was your age, actually second grade, we had a presidential election. This guy named George H.W. Bush was running for president. And I remember that I would get into political discussions about politics when I was 8 years old. So now I'm asking you, you're seven, you're going to be eight soon, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you guys talk about politics at school?
No.
That's smart. Does nobody brings anything up about who the president is or anything like that?
No, not really.
What do you guys talk about? Like with your friends?
Funny things. Things that have happened that are fun.
Hmm. Do you guys talk about dolls or ponies or what's the latest thing right now if you're a first grade girl?
Sometimes you talk about what we're going to play.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes when I played with Morgan, we'd be playing one game, but then when we started playing it, we'd start playing a whole different game without us noticing.
Wow, that sounds like politics to me. Yeah, good stuff. Well, perfect. So what do you think? What do you think about being on the radio? You like it?
Uh-huh.
Okay, good stuff. Well, all right. There it is. Now, yeah, so now when you go back out there, you're going to help Robbie play some more clips?
Yes.
Push some more buttons and do all that good stuff? Okay. All right, well, let's take a quick break now. Let's hear it for Vera. Yay! First time on the show. And actually, when we come back, we have our Friday Funny segment is about video games. And since I know nothing about video games, I actually asked for an expert to come on and do a guest appearance. So that person will be up next. Sam Rogowski, Sam Nation, here with Vera.
I was listening the other day to a friend of mine. His name is Sam, Sam Majowski. You'll find him very anything. He's very stylish. He's always wearing his suit. And if you want to hear someone's opinion that absolutely is correct, you listen to Sam. Anyone else is a waste of time.
Sam Rogowski. Okay, Friday Funny. Here we go right into it. Apparently, parents are paying tutors to help their kids. This is not new, especially if you live in an area where, you know, parents are very competitive. Schooling's important. You want to give your kids a competitive edge. Make sure they do well on testing. Advance grade level to grade level as needed. And then are prepared to go to college or at least get the grades so they can even go to college, right? You know the drill. Well, there is a whole new level of insanity reached by parents who want the best for their kids. And that now is hiring tutors to help their kids to play Fortnite. Now, in the studio, I have, because I know nothing about video games, and this is one thing I, as your host, will always do. If there is something I don't understand, I will tell you. I don't get it. So I'm not like CNN trying to talk about Trump. I don't understand video games, so I have no idea what they're all about. So now I have the expert from our household here talking about Fortnite. Daniel, welcome to the program.
Hello.
You're going to have to get closer to the mic, buddy. You're being way too comfortable. All right, can you hear it? Can you get close?
Yeah, I can hear it.
All right, there you go. Now, tell me what Fortnite is. Because I didn't know what Fortnite was until you told me what it was. So what is it?
Well, people know what Hunger Games is, right?
Hunger Games,
yeah.
Yes.
So there's like a bus. If you pick where you want to land, like Greasy Grove, and then you jump out of the bus, glide over there. There's 100 people. 5 minutes, it's 33 people, usually. Well, you land there. There's only can be one winner, or two in duos, or four in squads.
Okay, so you basically have to be the last man standing. That's the idea, right? And how do you eliminate people? You have to kill them?
Yep.
Okay. And is it a hard game?
Nope, if you know how to play.
So what do you think? Should Mom and I hire a tutor to help you play Fortnite?
If I want to be ninja good, yeah.
So what happens? Why would you want to be this good? Is there a benefit to it? Are there tournaments or something?
Yep, and you can win like $500,000 a year.
Are you serious?
I'm not joking.
So there's guys that play it professionally?
Yep.
So is that what you're going to do instead of going to college?
I don't know.
No, this is what's so surprising to me. So there are not only, and we're sharing a microphone here, and there's a little bit of a height difference. Okay, so the thing about this is, what do you think? What about these gamers right here in that picture? Do they look like your standard video gamers right here?
Yeah.
Yeah? What are the headsets? Why do they have headsets with microphones on them?
So they can talk to, like, people on their team if they do squads, duos.
So it's like team play?
Yeah.
All right. Well, private tutoring in the U.S., so you know how you go for tutoring for school? Do you know that's a $7 billion a year industry? That's a lot of money in the U.S. That's how much people like Mom and I spend on their kids. But I've never heard of people getting tutored for video games. Do you have any friends that are getting tutored to play better video games?
I don't know, unless they haven't told me.
Do you think they would tell you? Or do you think they would be like sly about it and not tell you and then just show up and kick your money?
Depends who.
Depends who?
Yeah.
So do you always team up with the same people, or do you sometimes play against your friends?
Yeah, I can sometimes play against my friend.
Yeah. What other video games are cool right now?
Overwatch?
What is that game about?
You have to pick a character out of, like, 30 characters or something. You pick one, and then you have to go move the payload, or you have to capture the objective.
What's the objective? Like, is it like a treasure or something?
No, it's just a little area.
Oh, you have to get somewhere in the
game. Yeah, it goes like percentage from like 1 to 100.
Okay. Well, your favorite game right now is what? Overwatch?
Fortnite.
Okay. So, all right. Well, there it is. So I think this is absolutely crazy. I read this article and I was blown away. But you actually think that, what do you think about people hiring tutors?
It's absurd.
All right, there you have it. Daniel and Sam Merjovsky. Oh, I can't say that on air. Sorry. We'll be back after this.
You're looking for a show that doesn't sugarcoat the truth. Sam Nation will accommodate you.
Sam Rajofsky, okay. That was fun. It's great to have my kids here, and they wanted to come visit before the school year started, so here we go. You know this whole abolish ICE movement? This, to me, is also a non-starter. You've actually have prominent Democrats in Congress, in the Senate, political talkers and the like, talking about getting rid of ICE. This is the most fascinating part about this argument is that Trump is actually only enforcing laws that have been on the books for years. And some of the same people that are telling, are going on TV and talking about abolishing ICE are the people that wrote the law to begin with. And if they didn't write the law, they've been in office for years and years and could presumably do something about it if they don't like the policy. But see, this is where these guys talk out of both sides of their mouth, because on one hand, right, on one hand, no member of Congress wants to get up and say, yeah, we want open borders, actually, right, because that will come haunt them in races and elections that come down the road. Instead, they prefer the soft approach. They like presidents like George W. Bush and presidents like Obama who don't enforce properly immigration law, and so everybody gets off the hook. Well, now here we have Senator Mazie Hirono, Democrat Hawaii, taking to task ICE official Matthew Albanese in a Senate hearing on Tuesday, This exchange is classic. And I'm just going to say here, I'm going to say, this woman is a senator. Listen up.
I think we're missing the point. These individuals are there because they have broken a law. There has to be a process.
They have broken a law only as deemed so by the president with his...
No, ma'am. They're there for violation of Title 8 of the immigration of the U.S. Nationality Act. That's illegal entry is both a criminal and civil violation. They are in those FRCs pending the outcome of that civil immigration process. They have broken the law.
Well, these are mainly, my understanding is that under zero tolerance, these are no longer civil proceedings, but in fact, were criminal proceedings.
They were criminal proceedings when the Border Patrol prosecuted them, but at the conclusion of that process, once the individual came into ICE custody, they would go through administrative proceedings.
I'm confused.
Okay.
So the
criminal proceeding is an individual being prosecuted for the criminal violation of improper entry.
Oh, my gosh. There's a criminal proceeding and a civil proceeding. It's normal. This happens. It happens in other places in criminal law. For example, if you securities exchange violations, right? You get charged with a felony, but then there's also disgorgement proceedings that come after the money. Normal, okay? This woman is sitting in Congress, is sitting in the Senate, has no idea what the law is, how it is, and she's an idiot. And by the way, she's from Hawaii. You know what's funny about this? I can't even go to Hawaii with my dog without my dog getting, you know, arrested at the airport and put in a cage. Every time you're leaving Hawaii, they want to take all my fruit, even though I promised to consume it on the airplane. I mean, this is a state that is absolutely rabid in its protection of its border. And this kind of demagoguery, this kind of... It doesn't affect them, right? I mean, Hawaii's out there in the middle of the Pacific. You know, they're not getting any illegal swimming, you know, swimming across the Pacific. So, we haven't had the cartels infiltrate towns on, let's say, the Big Island the same way they have in Arizona, Texas, Utah, Arizona, and the like. But this vile piece of human debris here, who's living on tax dollars, is pontificating about how this isn't the law and it's just something Trump, the president, does. And the guy goes, no, ma'am, it's in the U.S. code. It's the law. I don't even know what to say. So I won't say anything else. Sam Rogowski, back right after this.
And now, ladies and gentlemen,
Now, ladies and gentlemen, on the show tonight is Sam Rogowski. Now, what Sam is the leading word in correct thinking, as opposed to Ed, which is drunk thinking. And that's usually where the left ends up, on the wrong side of right.
Sam Rogowski, Sam Nation, all right. Here we go. I'll tell you, it's been quite a week. I have to tell you about San Francisco. I promised I would do this. So we went. Sherry did great in the race, ran the half marathon. She's here, so congratulations, Sherry. You did great. I had an opportunity to go for a little run myself early on Sunday. And so I leave my hotel on Market Street, if you're familiar where Market Street is, right by Union Square in San Francisco. And I'm heading toward the Embarcadero. This, by the way, is a really nice, bougie part of town. It's the financial district. And I'm running toward the waterfront, toward the Embarcadero. And as I'm running along, 6:10, 6:05, something in the morning, I suddenly look up, and there is a homeless man with his pants down peeing into a trash can right in front of me. Yeah, I saw that, by the way. If you're a runner, you know that, you know, timing is what your pace is, what your mile pace is on a run is a good thing. I had a 5.5 minute mile, that mile where I saw that. That's how fast I ran away from that. I was flying. I remember Market Street between, let's say, Grant or even past that, you know, where the cable cars are, where the Westfield Mall is, to the Embarcadero being relatively clean. And homeless issues, you know, being more over, let's say, toward the Tenderloin. But I noticed something else, and I'll get more into this next week, but I noticed something else is, you know, all the homeless that are there and all the locals that are streaming by them, coming out of office buildings and everything, all these very progressive San Francisco people. And you know one thing I did not notice a lot of? I didn't notice a lot of charity. I mean, that is to say, I didn't notice a lot of people stopping and giving money. Sherry, did you? It's interesting because we go, you know, Sherry and her family, they're all from Utah. We go to Utah quite a bit. And when I'm in Salt Lake City, I mean, I see people giving to homeless. It's feeding the pigeons, right? I'm not for it, but I see people giving money to the homeless all the time. And it's commonplace. And, you know, it's part of a pattern and practice. Liberals, especially ones that are hardcore like those found in San Francisco, they always want to give away other people's money. They want to be charitable with your cash, not their cash. And that's why you've got a city that spends, it's like 11, the equivalent of $11,000 a year per resident, which is more than New York City does. It is a city that has no excuse for any homelessness or any shabbiness or anything of the like. And yet it is filthy. It's gross. When I ran at 6 a.m, all I smelled was piss. Beautiful coastal city, and that is what I smell. It's infuriating, and this is why all these socialist Democrats, they want the entire country to look like San Francisco. I mean, that is an example of an American city that has absolutely for years been taken away by the French, you know, lunatic left. And what do they have to show for it? More, they have more. They have enough money to make Solomon blush, and yet they cannot get the urine off their sidewalks. Give me a break. Okay, have a great weekend. Remember, folks, if you have a friend, tell them about the podcast. Show them how to do it. iTunes, Sam Nation. And a special thank you to assistant producer Vera today and our guests. Daniel, thank you for explaining Fortnite. That was very helpful. Have a great weekend, guys. Thank you so much. Keep on learning.